Weather Brains.
This time on Weather Brains.
You know, when there's this many people that are killed, it's just not. It just doesn't sit well, no matter how you feel about it.
20 die when tornadoes slam into Central Florida. What could people there have done?
The real key is to not be in the manufactured housing in the middle of a strong tornado.
It's a familiar problem with a possible answer some people just don't get.
At 2 a.m., I can't beat on the television screen and tell you to turn the TV on because there's a tornado bearing down on you.
Also, how good of a job does the news media do covering weather and climate issues?
You take the newspaper article as the truth.
Don't expect to hear a lot of compliments on this topic.
When these folks talk about no warning and we have major networks saying no warning, there needs to be some kind of accountability there.
And what's this? The waters of the mighty Mississippi River actually flowing backwards? Is this some scary disaster movie? Nope, it actually happened. We'll hear about it. It's all coming up. Welcome to episode number 54 of Weather Brains, the netcast that's all about weather, produced by the Weather Company from Birmingham, Alabama. I'm David Black. With us this time, James Spann from ABC 3340 in Birmingham, Alabama as well. Hey, James, how you doing?
David, I'm excited. How are you?
Doing superbly, just excited that we're getting closer, maybe to some warmer temperatures across the eastern U.S. Is that a possibility?
It'll get here maybe in March.
So okay, well.
Just hang on.
I was thinking a little sooner than that, but maybe not.
You know,
Brian.
When it's 42 below zero in the Minnesota Arrowhead, you know, it's going to take a while to get rid of this stuff.
So I'm being a little overly ambitious is what I'm taking from you there.
I guess if you're talking 50s, we might can give you that.
All right, I can handle that. Brian Peters, hey, what are you doing?
I'm trying to stay warm with all this cold weather in the South. But just when I think it's really cold here, my daughter in Chicago mentions that it was like 1 degree today.
How do they function in that? I don't know.
Well, she said the other day when she was walking to the theater, where part of what she does is in the theater, that the only thing you could see were slits where everybody's eyes were. Otherwise, everything was covered.
I understand that. Jason Simpson with us on this netcast as well. Mr. Simpson, it's good to have you. You can't always join us because of your erratic work schedule, but this is a treat.
Yeah, it does get kind of crazy, but I enjoy being here. Thanks a lot for having me.
And we are especially proud that you are out on bond. You know, you're out in the
yeah.
free world.
Last week I was in prison, but this week I'm back out.
They've got you some special circumstances. Kevin Selly, our Texas affiliate person, is with us as well. Kevin, what's the situation with the weather in the Southern Plains? You guys, are you shipping any more cold air our way?
We got a chance to warm up a little bit, David, here at least for the next couple of days. You know, the jet stream pattern's flattening out a little bit, and so that certainly helps us. But I wanted to take a moment to wish everyone Happy Weather Person's Day and hope that someone would ask me what Weather Person's Day was so my research wouldn't go to waste.
Well, I'll bite. Tell us about the history of Weather Person's Day.
Well, I didn't even know about it until recently, but I spent all of about 47 and a half seconds researching it when I found out it was indeed Weather Person's Day, and it celebrates the fact that on November 30th, 1784, a Boston physician and scientist named John Jeffries went along with balloonist Jean-Pierre Blanchard on a 1 hour, 21-minute flight on which he took some weather instruments and made what are generally accepted to be the first upper air measurements from a balloon. And February 5th is Dr. Jeffries' birthday, so I hope you all got my card in the mail.
That's interesting.
I didn't get any gifts or any card.
I was just thinking about you, Brian, because didn't you do the upper air balloons in 1785?
Yes.
Following year?
Yeah.
So you just missed it by a year, but...
Yes, anyway.
So happy
I was doing them
today.
Oh, I like to think we're a bunch of mature individuals in this program, but somehow that's
You'd
just...
You'd be wrong.
Yeah. You shouldn't think that.
And, you know, I noticed, too, that Spann and Simpson are just kind of laying back, not really getting involved in this. They don't want to get their hands dirty.
I know why James is laying back.
Why is James laying back?
Because of all that attention he's had over the last couple of weeks and his foray into global warming.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, he's the global warming magnet. Tell you what, James, you've had your share of attention. Have you been able to get any more sleep-filled nights after all of the uproar?
It's calmed down, and I really think it's opened the door for some people to speak out. I mean, I just notice, you know, people now are just sending me all these articles about people that share my viewpoint on this, so maybe somebody somewhere will start to listen to the other half of the argument, which I hopefully will be the case.
Yeah, and you know, that big email you got, James.
Yeah, you've got a lot of email.
That you got last week that you shared with us. Tell them who it was from.
Well, I got an email out of the blue from Dr. William Gray.
Wow.
The legendary Dr. Gray from Colorado State University. Of course, he's been on this program before, but, David Black, you interviewed Dr. Gray, and we didn't, and I don't know if he connected me with this show or not, but just out of the blue, he sent me a very gracious email message last week thanking me for what I had to say and supporting what I said and just kind of reaffirming, you know, what he's told us over the years. So I thought that was very nice. And again, the number of scientists, climatologists, and meteorologists that are coming out of the woods, out of the closet, if you will, and, you know, saying that, you know, this catastrophic man-made global warming thing, we need to think twice about that, is pretty amazing. So I just think there's a flood now from the other side, and hopefully people will open up and listen to both sides of the issue.
And I know that in future netcasts, we're certainly going to be addressing this because it's just becoming more and more a part of the mainstream news media's coverage. And we will continue to endeavor to bring different people into the mix and let people hear, hopefully, some perspectives that they are generally not otherwise getting a chance to hear. Speaking of email, James, I know you have had a tremendous amount of email come in to ABC 3340 Television, and we've had a lot come in the past few weeks into Weather Brains as well, and something that you said kind of surprised me a little bit, but then on the other hand, I know you, James, and this didn't surprise me. We got all this email coming in to Weather Brains, and you said you sat down and answered every one of them. Is that right?
Yeah, it takes a long time, and I've always tried to answer email. And one of the reasons I can do that, I don't deal with a telephone. I gave up on that, but slowly but surely I've whittled away with it, and I've tried to respond to everybody. So
okay, so hopefully everybody that's emailed got an answer, and I've answered several today. But the bottom line is we read everything that comes in, and just thank folks for taking the time to drop an email our way, the address being question@weatherbrains.com. A lot of people submitting comments and ideas and thoughts and just all sorts of perspectives on some of the many things going on in the weather and climate world. And one of the things that has happened in the weather world is very tragic, starting off the month of February. In the middle of the night, 20 people die when powerful tornadoes rip through central Florida. Happened February 2nd. At least 14 of the fatalities came during a two-minute period. Hardest hit Lake County, northwest of Orlando. That's where our Bill Murray talks with emergency management and National Weather Service personnel.
Early Friday morning, thunderstorms exploded across central Florida and resulted in the second deadliest tornado outbreak ever in the Sunshine State. Chris Patton is the public information officer for Lake County's Emergency Management Agency. He has been looking at some of the hardest hit areas. Chris, first, our prayers and sympathies go out to all the people of Central Florida for the death and devastation that these tornadoes have brought to your area. How are things there now?
Extremely busy. We have a lot of things going on. Debris management is definitely an issue. We're trying to get these areas cleared up. We got about 1,200 cubic yards of debris hauled out of these areas. Another issue that we're working is obviously FEMA's here. They've set up some disaster recovery centers, and we're encouraging people to start signing up for some FEMA assistance.
The pictures are just horrific, Chris. Can you tell us, I noticed that a lot of the devastation appears to be in areas that were populated by mobile homes, and I understand that a large percentage of the fatalities were in mobile homes. So is there anything in that area that was there to make those places safer for people that were living in manufactured housing?
That's somewhat true, but these storms were categorized, I believe the National Weather Service came out Saturday and did their investigative work, and they released a report Sunday that these were F3s, two separate F3 tornadoes with winds of up to 160, 165 miles per hour. And while there was manufactured homes that were damaged, it also took out site-built structures. I was I was out Friday night at a home, and it was a brick home that was unfortunately destroyed.
Well, the lead times from the Weather Service were good, but I think when you're awakened in the middle of the night with 10 minutes to get to a real shelter, I think that's almost an impossible task to ask of almost anybody. And I've heard a few stories, even a story of a dog that awakened its owner and allowed them to just dive into safety at the last minute. Any other great stories or redeeming stories of hope in the midst of this tragedy?
There's tons of great stories out there. A couple of them, I think, are that we opened four shelters, you know, immediately after this disaster hit. And we only peaked out at like 27 shelterees. And I think a lot of that was because the neighbors and the community pulled together and found places for these people to stay.
That is awesome. People taking care of people. That's a great story in the midst of a disaster like this. What can our listeners do to help, Chris?
Anytime of a disaster, we have Salvation Army here and Red Cross, and those are nonprofit, you know, disaster relief agencies, and they can use all the donations they can get.
Thanks to you for speaking with us today, and best of luck to you and everyone there in Central Florida.
Thank you very much. Keep us in your prayers.
Will do. That was Chris Patton, the Public Information Officer for Lake County, Florida, where the devastating tornadoes happened Friday morning. The storms were sort of a worst-case scenario for forecasters. We have Bart Hagemeyer, who is the meteorologist in charge at the National Weather Service in Melbourne, Florida, which has responsibility for two of the hardest-hit counties. Can you kind of set the scene for us? What caused this terrible outbreak to occur during the early morning hours?
To really set the scene properly, you have to go back really to the fall. We've done a lot of research on tornadoes, not only tornado climatology, but tornado forecasting here. If you go back to really what was a moderate El Nino at the time back in October, you know, we'd actually developed an experimental seasonal forecast, a storminess forecast, and based on the El Nino, which was peaking at about 1.25, 1.3 above normal out in the Pacific, we found there's a really strong correlation to El Nino and severe weather outbreaks in Florida. If you go back to, of course, 97, 98, when we had the worst tornado outbreak on the night of February 22nd and 23rd, it killed 42 people. But what people don't remember is that there was literally 18 different winter storms that came through Florida that winter. And what we find with El Nino is that just storminess increases tremendously. And as we know, there's a number of severe weather parameters that have to come together to produce severe weather. And when you have so many Gulf Coast storms like we had in 97, 98, sooner or later one of them is going to produce violent tornadoes. Well, we had a lot of violent tornadoes back in 97 and 98, and then again in 2002, 2003, with a pretty weak El Nino, but still we had a killer tornado down in Miami in March. And the last 3 years, we've had literally no tornadoes in the wintertime in Florida. We've been largely in neutral La Nina conditions. So going into this dry season, which is basically November to April in Florida, with the moderate El Nino developing, we actually produced a briefing package and briefed the state emergency managers and put out statements at the end of October saying that this was going to be a more active severe weather season, particularly in the since the last 3 or 4 years. Well, we had tornadoes in Tallahassee in late October. We had F1 tornadoes in Orlando on Election Day, and then we had really strong F2 tornadoes in Daytona Beach on Christmas. So to kind of put this outbreak into context, what we generally find in El Nino years come February is when the really bad severe weather events hit. So this one, in the big picture thing, is not at all really out of the ordinary as far as putting it into the big picture context of the El Nino and the severe weather season. That's a lot of information, but that's just all the information that leads up to the event itself.
I guess this is really your primary storm season now anyway.
Right. There's, there's a little bit of misunderstanding. I mean, I listen to a lot of people talk, the people in the media and other people that kind of have to put this into context for the listeners, but sometimes the context is not really right. I mean, we have our traditional tornado season in the summer. We have a lot of Florida, I think, ranks up there in the top three or four for tornadoes. Most of those tornadoes come in the summertime, and they're F0s, and they don't last very long. But it's actually our peak severe weather season is February and March, and this is the time when we do get these big, strong tornadoes. And they're not the same, of course, as the summertime tornadoes. They tend to be stronger and long-tracked. And also, for reasons that we don't, I've been studying these things for almost 20 years. I came from Missouri, and it was went to the University of Missouri, did a lot of severe weather research out there. We don't really know why. It's kind of counterintuitive, but we see some of the most intense supercells late at night, which is pretty much the opposite of what you see out in the traditional tornado alley where they're tied to diurnal heating. That obviously leaves us with particular preparedness issues because they do come late at night.
Do you have any theories as to why the storms may be more severe at night in Florida?
No, because you would think that there's killer tornadoes occur at night just because that's when people are sleeping, and if there's fewer deaths when in the daytime when people are awake. But when you actually look back at the events, for example, the February 22nd, 23rd, 1998 event, all of the fatalities occurred after midnight, and it was kind of I guess that's the part about this tornado outbreak that's kind of hard for me to take personally, because it's kind of like history repeating itself all over again. The same issues were raised back in 98. They said, the warnings went out in time to take action, and people weren't aware of them. And after that, the state bought weather radios for all the schools, all the public buildings, all the nursing homes and things like that, and there was a run on weather radios. And even during the hurricane season, there was kind of a run on weather radios, but they're not, they have to be bought and turned on and set up properly.
You could actually see the passion in the statements coming from your office, early Friday morning. You could just feel the forecasters trying to reach out and tell people. What was it like to be there in the office during this event?
Well, it's just, I don't know, it's something peculiar about our area. I mean, I started out doing the research on El Nino years ago, and we talk about the increased risk of severe weather and tornadoes, and unfortunately, in both cases, the tornadoes and all the deaths were right in our own forecast warning area, which is really, really kind of strange and sobering in some way that we talk about this event and we get ready for it, and I can imagine the forecasters are putting out the forecast, and but then there's never. When there's this many people that are killed, it just doesn't sit well, no matter how you feel about it. And it's just a tough thing to go through. This is now 62 people that have died in two different events in the last two El Ninos, and they're all in our county warning area. So it's a pretty, you can imagine it's pretty hard on the forecasters. I mean, it's our job and all, but still, it's a pretty sobering responsibility.
That's for sure. It seemed to me, and I've heard news reports, that a lot of the deaths, or a large majority of them, occurred in manufactured housing. Is that what you've actually seen on site down there in Florida?
Yeah, we haven't verified that. I think all the deaths were in manufactured housing. I was out there at Lake Mac and the area east of Lake Mac, and then around Lady Lake, and looking at them, I think they were all in manufactured housing. Of course, that's a challenge down here in Florida. That's an affordable lifestyle option, especially out in rural areas or retirement communities. And that's a challenge. I guess one of the things when you think about, Craig Fugate's Florida Department of Emergency Management. I've been working with him for years, and we always talk about how do you change outcomes. And then if you live in a manufactured home, even if you get the warning, then you still have to say, well, what do I do now? And to actually seek cover in the manufactured housing, you may, if you knew it was coming and you tried to hide in the manufactured housing, you may or may not survive. In a lot of cases, it may not have made any difference. The real key is to not be in the manufactured housing in the middle of a strong tornado. One of the things, too, that comes out of this is that you have to have a strategy for dealing with severe weather. And in cases like these winter storms in Florida, they don't just pop up without warning. Usually, as you'll find in this case, in the Christmas one, that we're mentioning them in our hazardous weather outlooks in the morning. Like we mentioned it Thursday morning at 5 o'clock in the morning, and then again at 5 o'clock Thursday evening in the Storm Prediction Center. They had Florida in a slight risk is Wednesday night and all through the day Thursday. And so if you live in we talked about the El Nino and the fact that we had a Christmas storm and everything. So if people are kind of tuned, you got to be tuned into the weather, almost like a hurricane situation where, okay, there's a winter storm brewing in the Gulf. And if I live in a manufactured housing, maybe I want to spend the night with some friends or relatives that have a solid home somewhere. Now, some of these storms are strong enough to devastate, concrete block stucco homes. But still, in those kind of homes, usually if you take shelter in the you know, like a bathroom or interior home, interior hallway, it's pretty unlikely that you know, that there'll be total devastation of a CBS home. We've never had an F5 tornado in Florida, and only a couple of F4s, and they were way back in the 60s. And you know, when you think about the survey and the data back then, it was kind of shaky. So you know, F3, F4 is really the upper limit of what Florida tornadoes would probably be. So most concrete block homes, if you have a safe room or go to the right place, probably be survivable.
Well, that's what we preach here in Alabama, because we, you know, are of course kind of in the toe of the Dixie Tornado Alley up here, and we preach that, having a plan, because we have a high preponderance of residents living in mobile homes too. How did the new E-Fujita scale change how you looked at these storms, Bart, as you did the survey assessments?
And since this was the very first one, unfortunately, the scale just went into effect. So we were looking at the damage, and when you're looking at mobile homes, you know, the new scale, pretty much, you know, mobile homes are just totally blown away and reduced to just small pieces at the F3 level. So we were already beyond, you know, they were gone. I mean, there was nothing left of the mobile homes. So we started looking at other indicators that might help us to see whether we had an F4 or not. And the only other indicators we had were trees. Now, of course, pine trees, they snap off pretty easily. You know, you can see that with maybe an F1 or something. But we found over there in the Lake Mack area, there was a big stand of live oaks that were, and some other hardwood trees that were just totally debranched and defoliated, and really just, you know, violated like you see out in Oklahoma sometimes. So there was some indication that maybe with the tree damage, it might be pushing F4, but, you know, we need to do a little more research into that, because we don't really have any other indicators other than the trees for going up higher like that. The storms largely missed, CBS single-family homes, except in the villages, and there the storm wasn't quite as strong. So, yeah, it's a challenge. We tried to, of course, it was a big area to survey. We had to cover about 80 miles, and we went up by helicopter. And the interesting thing, it's hard to imagine, but, of course, it could have been a lot worse, because a supercell, which is pretty intense, probably stronger supercell than we saw maybe even in February 98, it went over Lady Lake, and between Lady Lake and Lake Mack is a real large, like, pretty much forested area. You know, it's just savanna with forests. It went over really largely unpopulated area, and there's a town in the middle there called Umatilla that actually is pretty densely populated, and it produced no tornado there. It was definitely off the ground there for quite a while before it sat down again in the Paisley Lake Mack area. So we could see you kind of need a helicopter to do that. But again, even as bad as it was, the worst of the damage was really spotty. I mean, overall, you know, how the tornado damage is, it's mostly F1 damage with intermittent F2 and EF3 damage. That's kind of the way we won't be able to map it in that much detail, but that's pretty much, you know, I think we're pretty confident at the very high end of the EF3. We just didn't have enough visual evidence to go to F4. Sometimes when we go out and do surveys, of course, like, you know, Saturday, you know, there's the people are still walking around the remains of their homes. You know, the people that have lost their, when we talked to one lady who lost her mother, and another person that found a couple of neighbors that were, you know, blown into his back area there. And it's always kind of awkward to go out there because you have to do your job and do the surveys. And of course, but the people are always kind of in a special place where they feel better about, you know, talking about their experiences and even showing us around the property and things like that. And that's kind of the way, you can probably tell, it's kind of the way the forecasters are. Sometimes it's kind of nice just to talk for a little bit, and then makes things feel a little better.
I guess you can really feel that connection when you're in the field.
And in fact, we sent some of our people out that didn't get a chance to go out to the field just for the main thing, for a training experience, just to go out there and see what, you know, F3 damage looks like. Because sometimes when you're looking at the radar screen, it helps to kind of make that connection between what's on the radar and what's happening out there on the ground.
Wow. Well, a great job again by the National Weather Service Melbourne in preparing that area and getting the warnings out. And good luck to you and the entire team there at the National Weather Service in Melbourne. Thank you for spending time with us today.
All right. Thank you.
President Bush has declared Lake County, three other central Florida counties as well, federal disaster areas. That means that residents affected by the storms will be eligible for some funding assistance to try to get back on their feet. At least 1,500 homes were heavily damaged or destroyed in those tornadoes.
I'll tell you, let me encourage people to read Murray's blog post on that, David. He did an excellent job of putting some radar data together, the tracking maps and information on warning times, and it was just a wonderful way of describing how the warning process worked wonderfully. The problem was that people just didn't hear the warning. And
how many times have we had that happen before?
Yeah, and you know, I picked up the local newspaper. The newspaper, the daily paper in this market, which is Birmingham, and the headline read on Saturday, as I recall, you know, that the people had no warning, or unwarned was the word in the headline. Where do they get that? It was an excellent warning, they just didn't hear it. And
I think the National Weather Service is supposed to send people knocking on their doors or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I guess for some journalist, if, you know, some government official doesn't come beat on the door and pull you and your family out of there and drag you down to a tornado shelter, then that's not adequate warning. And that's just not right. So there was an excellent warning for that, as you heard in the piece there that Bill did, just the people didn't hear it. And that's why we've got to get a weather radio in every home in tornado-prone areas. And forget the sirens. I think one of the major networks did a story on the lack of sirens this evening. And forget it. You know, we've got to get a weather radio in every home. It's that simple. And hopefully this will wake some people up to that fact.
I think this is a real case where, especially on the journalism side of things, kind of getting away from the actual warning process, journalists, you got to be careful what you say. Because you're telling the entire country that this area had no tornado warning, that the people had no idea anything was coming. I don't know what the television coverage was like out of the Orlando TV market. I have no idea what it's like down there. But it's just like you say often, James, and you know, I've said it to school kids in the past. You know, at 2 a.m., I can't beat on the television screen and tell you to turn the TV on because there's a tornado bearing down on you. There's no way to do that. So, you know, when these folks talk about no warning and we have major networks saying no warning, there needs to be some kind of accountability there. I really think. I mean, that's just me being me, I guess. I don't know.
Well, maybe somebody in the Birmingham News will come on the show here and explain their headline.
I think that'd be great. Accountability. You know, we're scientists and journalists, I guess, to some extent, because we're both you and I and Brian. We're both on television, and we do the weather meteorology side of it. And I would like to see more accountability. You know, from top to bottom, not only in science reporting, not only in without warning, not only with global warming. But there are a lot of things in the media, and I know this is not a harp on the media podcast, but...
Oh, go ahead.
you want me to get on that?
Just let it out, Jason.
Just let it out.
Send the hate mail to jason@abc3340.com.
Well, you know, I went through one of the tougher news writing classes in the country, I believe, over at Mississippi State. Laura DeFore was the teacher, and there were two people that made an A that entire semester, and I happened to be one of them, only because I was on television and I got bonus points for bringing in tapes.
Ooh.
So, you know, there's a lot to know about news writing, and I'm not claiming to be a great journalist, but there are standards, there are ethics of journalism that just are not being upheld here.
You say the accountability, but to take that to the next step, there is no accountability anymore. Who's going to hold them accountable? I mean, other than us calling them on the show, and that's what's really disappointing is that it's almost like there's no governing body anymore. Because the standards are gone. The only motivation now is to just draw a crowd by saying the most sensational thing that you can.
What about this? And this is an idea that we kind of toss around a lot through emails, through looking at different media-related blogs. And James, you're the expert on this as far as I'm concerned, because sometimes you literally just scare the pants off me about the future of the business of television. But when you talk about accountability in the government is with the people, correct? Well, it's supposed to be. In democracy, in theory, it lies with the people. Well, the accountability and the power that the media have is derived from the people who consume that media. So if our television station decided that we were no longer going to report the news that happened, we were just going to be sensational journalists and go around and find the most crazy thing we could think of and put this weird spin on it, be it conservative or liberal, I think the people of the Birmingham television market would say, hey, you know what, we're not going to watch that TV station anymore. And I think that that may be one of the reasons that you're seeing some of the bigger media, some of the, especially some of the newspapers, I think that may be why you're seeing them fall off a little bit. Well, because people are getting tired of it, and they're getting their news somewhere else from some blogs.
Let me make this perfectly clear. I love Birmingham News. I'm a subscriber. I hope they do well. I'd love to read. I have many good friends that work there. But, you know, they are in a survival mode.
Absolutely.
And newspapers are dying. And the television business is dying. Our business models are dying as the new media takes over. But we've got to be careful, as Jason says, to keep the integrity of what we do in place as we make the change to the new digital world. And that goes for weather in the science world and in journalism, too. And you have to be very careful. But, yeah, there's some really weird stuff out there.
Well,
and doesn't that prove, though, and I hate to say that, but doesn't that prove that the horse is out of the barn and not coming back? Because you cannot control all these outlets anymore. I mean, I'm not trying to say this doom and gloom all over. There are responsible outlets, but there are so many that aren't who are just trying to draw a crowd. I don't know that you can reel that back in.
But I believe that people have an inherent power and ability to help guide the quality of what these organizations present if they will just use that power. And it kind of goes back in a way to what Jason was saying. We don't get motivated enough as a society to hold organizations, various news media groups and the like, to a higher standard. Everybody's just kind of go with the flow and whatever they do is fine. And I don't buy that.
But you know, David, you really, as a newspaper reader, you've got to, you take the newspaper article as the truth.
Sure.
And it's like, we know, and I keep hearing James say this, and it's been a thought I've had many, many times, is when I see things like that Birmingham News headline that I knew was not correct, how many things in the newspaper are not correct about subjects I don't know anything about?
Right.
James has said this about news, you know, about the national news. You know, we see things like, you know, those articles about everybody believes in global warming and that it's caused by man, and, you know, and yet there were a bunch of us who didn't. And so it's, you don't, and it's hard to hold the Birmingham News accountable for that incorrect headline because people don't really know. And, you know, I don't have time to try to get a banner out there. Plus, there's more important things going on than the headline. So, I mean, how do you hold them accountable?
I nominate Peters as the guy that writes the letter to the editor.
Editor. I'm playing low key. I would like to take just a moment. One of the things that I have kept track of over the years is the number of deaths in tornadoes by state. I'm not throwing any stones when I say this, but there appears to be nobody who's really looking at these statistics. Now, I think SPC keeps some of these, but you can't really find one out there. And I was just looking at the spreadsheet I have on those statistics. And of course, 1998, that Bart Hagemeyer mentioned, is a big year we remember in Alabama because of the F5 tornado that we had here. And it's very interesting to look at 1998. The three highest death tolls in tornadoes were 42 in Florida, 34 in Alabama, and 21 in Georgia. Those are the three highest. Then you drop from the 21, you drop down. I think the next highest is 7, so it really drops off. What that says is Alabama, Georgia, and Florida had a significant number of powerful tornadoes to create those kind of death tolls. And remember, the 34 is 32 in an F5 and 2 in an F2. Okay, so it only took two tornadoes to produce the 34 deaths. What's really spectacular is when you look at 2006 and 1997, 1997 had 68 deaths from tornadoes. 2006 had 66. And now all of a sudden in 2007, in February, Florida is up there with 20. Louisiana's got 2. It's scary to think of the correlation that maybe, and I know that research has been done in Alabama on tornadoes, and there is a correlation between, it's not a real strong correlation, but there's a correlation between El Nino and tornadoes in the state of Alabama as well. So it's kind of scary to think, with our spring headed only just a month and a half away or so, of what we might expect in the southeastern U.S.
I wonder what it would suggest, Brian, if you overlaid those or compared the tracks in one state versus another and compared the terrain or the demographics of the terrain. Point being, in Oklahoma, if a strong tornado goes over fields, it's not going to take as many lives as opposed to one that goes right through downtown Orlando where the population is more dense. You see what I'm saying?
Yes. Oh, I know. Well, and the April 8th, 1998 F5 in Jefferson County was a perfect example of what you're talking about, I believe, because the Red Cross did a survey, the number of households affected by the tornado. I don't mean, just the number of houses and therefore the number of people, but the number of houses affected was around, as I recall, and don't hold me to the exact number, but around 1,100 households. Affected. If you move that tornado simply 3 miles east and southeast, the number of households affected goes up by a factor of almost four. And I've asked this question at severe weather meetings, is if 1,100 households resulted in 32 deaths, what would 5,000 households affected result in?
Yes.
And I don't think anybody, I don't think there's an answer to that question, but it certainly gives you pause for thought.
Yeah, there's been some research done with that, with regard to that here. They took the Moore, Oklahoma tornado and superimposed it on the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and a group called the North Central Texas Council of Governments. And I'm pretty sure all this information is available on their website, but I'll look. It's the North Central Texas Council of Governments did a big impact study taking that particular path and laying it right over the Dallas-Fort Worth area and showing what would become of that. In fact, people may have seen, there have been stories and television shows, I think one on the Discovery Channel and one on that other channel where some climatologist works, that sort of sensationalized that. But it's a pretty interesting study.
Yeah, and you can take Florida and say the same thing. What if it had been a little bit further south and east and roared straight through Orlando? It's just unthinkable. So it's something to be very aware of as we get into the spring, no doubt. Let me point out something, too, for our listeners to this netcast. Because of the severe weather outbreak in Florida, we had to do a change in programming. We had originally said that we would air a piece about the father of satellite meteorology, Dr. Vern Summey. We're going to hold that for a future netcast to accommodate everything that's been going on because it's so timely. We've got a new feature, too, we want to let you know. We think you'll enjoy here on Weather Brains. We all know Bill Murray is an incredible weather history fan. And he's going to put that knowledge to use for us in the form of a weekly feature we'll call This Week in Weather History.
This is Bill Murray. Here is a Weather Brains Extra. This Week in Weather History, a look back through the record books for remarkable weather events that occurred this week, the week of February 6th through the 12th. It was back on February the 7th, 1812, that the hard shock of the New Madrid earthquake series struck the area around the small farming community of New Madrid, Missouri. Seismologists estimate that the quake was an 8.8 on the Richter scale, making it the strongest to ever strike the lower 48. The Mississippi River actually ran backwards for a time, and a 3-mile-long island in the river disappeared. The 150-mile-long fault line is still active, and the major population centers of Memphis, Kansas City, and St. Louis lie in the danger zone. Another quake in that area would create tremendous damage. On February the 9th, 1870, President Ulysses S. Grant signed the bill into law that would order military installations across the United States to begin taking weather observations so that warnings could be issued along the coastlines of the U.S. It was the beginning of our modern National Weather Service. Weather forecasters in New York City called for light snow changing to rain on February the 9th, 1969. They did not foresee the development of a coastal low that dumped 15 to 20 inches of wet snow on the Big Apple. The storm is known as the Lindsay snowstorm for the political fallout that would beleaguer Mayor John Lindsay when he didn't get the streets cleared of the snow fast enough. It has only happened twice. Ice floes spotted flowing into the Gulf of Mexico from the Mississippi River on February the 12th, 1784. Ice actually blocked the river at New Orleans. It would happen again during the bitterly cold winter of 1899. And speaking of the great Arctic outbreak of 1899, it was in full swing on February the 12th, 1899. At least four states still record record lows from that outbreak, including Ohio, Nebraska, Florida, and Louisiana. And our hometown of Birmingham, Alabama, was not immune to the cold. On February the 13th, 1899, the city recorded its coldest temperature ever when the mercury fell to minus 10. Outlying areas around Birmingham recorded lows as cold as minus 14. If the observation had been taken at the airport then, our all-time record low would probably be minus 14. It was also minus 1 in Mobile that morning, minus 7 in Tuscaloosa, 15 below in Oneonta, and a bone-chilling minus 18 in Valley Head. There was also 5 inches of snow on the ground at Greensboro in south-central Alabama. That's This Week in Weather History. Back to David and the rest of the gang at Weather Brains.
Thank you, Bill Murray. Have you guys ever looked up weather trivia in an encyclopedia or a dictionary? You know whose picture is by the definition?
Bill Murray!
He's a plethora.
He knows it all, doesn't he?
He's a plethora of information. And he's good. He really knows that stuff.
I'm sitting here looking at some of the numbers up north. It's just amazing, David, you know, that this cold that's going on in Duluth, Minnesota. The high Sunday was 10 below. That tied the record low maximum for the date, which last occurred in 1895. So we're starting to see some of the coldest, you know, temperatures in a long time up there. So
can they just keep it up there? Well, we don't need it down here. Not that bad.
Just makes you wonder how cold it would be up there without global warming, huh?
I knew that was coming. I was ducking for that one.
I'm not going there.
Actually, a lady sent me a note while the show was on here. She's got relatives in St. Louis, and the weather guy at the station they watch said that on the air. So there's a lot of sarcasm floating around out there right now. So I'll stop before I get in trouble here.
Right, I think there's a lot of global cooling going on around the United States. Anyway, next time on Weather Brains, you heard Bart Hagemeyer with the National Weather Service in Melbourne a few moments ago talking about the enhanced Fujita scale in rating tornado damage. Well, next week we look at that new scale by talking with one of the people who was instrumental in revising it.
I'm excited to see how this is going to work out, and I'm very optimistic that it's going to make a great improvement in the quality of the data.
That's Dr. James McDonald, who worked with Dr. Ted Fujita and who helped lead the effort to revise the Fujita scale. So why do that? Well, tune in next time and find out. We hope you can join us. If you'd like to contact the Weather Geeks here at Weather Brains, our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. Don't forget, we have a toll-free telephone number you may use to leave voicemail for us. That number is 1-888-247-8627. 888-247-8627. A reminder that the opinions expressed on Weather Brains are not necessarily those of ABC 3340. And some of the music provided during this netcast came from the Podshow Podsafe Music Network, online at music.podshow.com. For the Weather Brains crew, the motley crew that they are, James Spann, Brian Peters, Jason Simpson, and Kevin Selly, I'm David Black, thanking you for listening. We hope you'll be able to join us again for our next Weather Brains netcast. Weather Brains is copyright 2007, all rights reserved. Adios, guys.
I think if you look up motley in the dictionary, it's James Spann's picture.
That's it, man.
He's an instigator. He's a troublemaker.
Hey, Brian, while David was copywriting us there, I found that website. It is the North Central Texas Council of Governments. And if you just punch in tornado on their search engine, you get this tornado damage risk assessment where they put the Moore tornado over the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And it's pretty chilling, some of that stuff in there.
But oh, yes.
I'm looking forward to the enhanced Vegeta piece next time, too. I think that'll be interesting.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. Enjoyed it.
Hey, James.
Good night.
James?
Yeah, I'll catch you on a separate call here.
Okay.
Ooh, the secret phone call.
Oh, they're going to talk about us. They're going to talk about us.
No, we'll talk about it right here.
Maybe they're going to talk about our raise. Right?
That does it. We're going to talk about it right here and make you guys listen to it.
I wanted the company you go.
I just want a gas card.
Oh, he's already disconnected.
I think he disconnected on you, James. He's expecting you to call.
Oh, yeah, he did. All right. See you guys.
Great. All right. Bye.
Bye.